Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Hemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resource Committee and TraumaCast. I'm Tatiana Cardenas, trauma, burns, and acute care surgeon at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas in Austin. Today, we're going to talk about ED versus OR intubations and the management of the airway in the traumatically injured patient. I am joined by two moderators from our very own Educational Resources Committee, as well as a distinguished panel of guests. I'll let everyone introduce themselves.
Great. Thanks for introducing the TraumaCast. We have a Philly theme to the moderators. My name is Zaf Kassim. I'm an emergency physician and surgical critical care intensivist here at Penn.
And I'm Liz Dower. I'm a trauma acute care surgeon at Temple in Philadelphia as well.
So, we're always kind of taught about this airway breathing and circulation, and that's really been taught for decades in all our life support courses, including ATLS. But we wonder whether that might actually be the best way forward. And to kind of discuss this topic in a little bit more detail, we have some fantastic guests today, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
My name is Paula Ferrara. I am the Division and System Chief for Trauma and Acute Care Surgery for Inova Health. And I am a professor for the University of Virginia.
Hey, I'm Sharvin Tagavi. I'm at Tulane University, University Medical Center in New Orleans, and happy to be here.
Great. Thank you so much for giving up your time today to join us. I think this will be a really timely topic, especially in light of Dr. Ferrara's recent paper in JAMA, just on this topic as well. So, for years, we've intubated patients in hemorrhagic shock, presenting to the trauma bay using that kind of ABC approach that we've been taught in ATLS. And, some of those folks do all right, but worryingly, there's a decent proportion of people who become more unstable or may even arrest after their airway management is undertaken, just following that usual paradigm. So we've often just put that down to, they were so severely injured and probably they were likely to die anyway. But, is that really the way we should be looking at this? That's really the crux of today's discussion on the TraumaCast. So I just wanted to kind of start it out by just talking about the general physiology. Say someone is not in shock, you're intubating them. Do you guys want to just take us through what kind of physiology to expect from after we administer medications and then actually transition them to positive pressure ventilation?
So I'm going to take a step back.
Sure.
Because I think you just said something very important. We think we intubate people and we have been taught that is airway breathing circulation and that airway equates to intubation. And then patients die and we think that because they were already too far gone. That's a great statement. I'm going to tell you that the first time that I saw the ATLS airway breathing circulation algorithm switch to circulation airway breathing, I was volunteering or following around my dad in Cali, Colombia when I was 12 years old. And the way that, and at that time, it was a capital of murder in the world. And there was a lot of, for people that don't know much about the political situation of my country, there was the guerrillas were fighting with the drug lords. The drug lords were fighting between Medellin and Colombia, and the civilian people were caught in between. So on top of the regular violence, there was gun violence, stabbings, and people were severely injured, to the point that we were in a war status in the university hospital. There was a bell, literally a bell, when somebody will come with injuries and hypotension and that they look with multiple injuries, multiple gunshot wounds, multiple stabs, and signs of shock, but still with signs of life, there was a bell that will be ringing in the emergency room, and the patient will completely bypass the ER and go to the OR for surgery and be ready to operate. I witnessed that changing paradigm, which of course at the time it wasn't written, because in Latin America, many places that are lower medium income countries, surgeons don't have the luxury of stop and write down what they do or publish what they do because they're too busy doing what they do and saving patients' lives. That was the first time that I saw that done. And that was the way that I thought trauma was done. And as I went through training in different places, in Miami and at the Deaconess, in Pittsburgh, at Shock Trauma, I observed that many trauma surgeons that were experienced practice the same way. Meaning, if you're intubating somebody with non-compressible hemorrhage, you're prepping at the same time, because you know the moment that you put that tube in the throat, that patient is going to decompensate, and then you're going to have to go faster in terms of controlling bleeding, or you're not going to have a beautiful algorithm followed, but not a patient that successfully survived it. So I just wanted to put that out there. Yes, we're not the ones who injure our patients. We don't crash their cars. We don't trip them. We don't shoot them. We don't stab them. And we need to still try our best to be able to give the patients an opportunity and a chance to survive. And I'm going to let Dr. Tagavi elaborate on that, because I don't want to completely hijack the podcast.
Yeah, I think I got interested in this topic several years ago. I also have a Philly connection, as Dr. Dower knows. She helped train me at Temple. Some of the, kind of like Dr. Ferrata said, some of the seasoned and more experienced trauma surgeons there were saying, hey, we see a lot of these patients come in by police transport, and those patients seem to do better. So, and also they would try to hold off on intubating in the trauma bay. If they could get the patient to the OR, as Dr. Ferrata said, you're starting to think about an airway when you're prepping. So you're closer to getting definitive hemorrhage control. You know, their experience there was that those patients did better. And so that's kind of how I got interested in the topic. And we even, took it a step further and studied it in animal models and the shock models of swine. So hemorrhagic shock models in swine. And we looked at different modes of ventilation, and we found that doing just passive, giving passive oxygen actually resulted in better physiology than when you give them positive pressure ventilation, whether that's by bag valve mask or intubation and manual breath. So what we saw was that you actually see decreased venous return as measured by central venous pressure, and that resulted in a decreased cardiac output and worsening perfusion of vital organs. So we saw higher lactate levels and worse end organ damage.
100%. So what happens when you're bleeding out is you start gasping for air, because you are trying to bring all the blood that is in your legs and in your gut into your heart, into your brain. It's the way of your body of not dying. Then on top of that, you get a very strong vasoconstriction. And so when you see a trauma patient that is about to code, maybe a blood pressure is going to be 150 over 100. It's not that the dynamap is broken. It's that your patient is trying not to die. Right? So then you decide, patient needs to go to the OR, let me intubate them first. So you give them pain control, you give them sedation, that's going to and then you give them paralytics. So that's going to not only stop the vasoconstriction, but produce vasodilation. And you're going to stop the gasping for air, you're going to paralyze them. And if that was not enough, then you're going to go ahead and give them a positive pressure ventilation. When you have positive pressure ventilation, you're going to kink your IVC, your venous return is going to decrease, your cardiac output is going to decrease, and that's how you get that patient. So out of interest, when I was working in another hospital before, and we had a patient that had multiple gunshot wounds, we had to open the chest. There was some resistance from emergency medicine, our emergency medicine colleagues, in opening the chest before intubating, even though the GCS was 3. There was still a steel athletic pulse, but our GCS was 3. And so then we had everything in life is an opportunity, right? So they had the opportunity to explain, this is what we're doing. But when you're practicing a certain way and it causes anxiety in other people and it starts clicking, why it causes so much anxiety in other people and lack of trust? And it's because they have been trained to believe in the trauma Bible, that is airway, breathing, circulation, and not understanding that airway could be just a little bit of oxygen, and then try to control the bleeding somehow. The first thing that I wrote, we went retrospectively at that place and looked at the people that had that were in extremis, people that got anything before intubation, blood or anything else, to the people that just got ventilation and then something else. I'm not only talking about a thoracotomy and clamping the aorta. I'm talking about small things like blood or, you know, something else. And the mortality was the difference between 70% and 50%. And so then we did a multicentric retrospective trial that was presented at WASC, but published in the World Journal of Surgery, where the difference in mortality was not statistically different, but it proved that people were already doing it. And since then, we have been trying to accumulate data to do a prospective trial on this. But yet, like Dr. Tagavi said, there's animal data that he has produced. There has been a group of people that really believe in this. Dr. Duchesny, Dr. Sacrison, Dr. Bilal Joseph, Dr. Sharmila Lisnake. There's a group of us that are already doing it that strongly believe that we should make a change. Dr. Jacobs, actually, we wrote together an editorial for American Journal of Surgery as well, that we believe that in these patients, that paradigm needs to be questioned in order for us to help the patient have a second chance at surviving.
So I think that sounds, you know, great, and it's ideal way to manage a patient for us here at, you know, urban level one trauma centers. But what do we tell the people in these rural hospitals that a patient shows up, or these small level three hospitals where there's no in-house surgeon that can immediately take the person to the operating room? What should we be advising those people to do in those emergency departments?
I think that's even more important that those people don't intubate. What is available to you is available tourniquets. I hate to bring the Reboa word because I know how all the controversy that word, but there's Reboa, there's blood products, euvolemic resuscitation, there's a permissive hypotension. There's many tools that you can use, and I think it's even more important for people that work in level three. So ATLS was made really not for people that are doing primary, secondary survey and all x-rays at the same time within 5 minutes because you're in a level one trauma center, right? ATLS was made for people that are not necessarily working with all the resources, but it's that much more important that those things are followed in those places. The American Heart Association a long time ago, this is not new, changed their protocols in stop intubating people, stop even back masking that fast and that often, just switch to chest compressions because of the physiology and understanding of physiology. Yet the traumatic cardiac arrest has fallen behind. So I don't know, Dr. Tagavi, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you have to do what you can to emphasize circulation, and that may be blood products, that may be a tourniquet, that may be Reboa. So if you're out at kind of a rural area, then you do what you can to maximize perfusion and try to hold off on intubation.
There was a group in Canada, and I heard these a while ago, I'm going to say it was maybe 2016, that two emergency medicine physicians, the Canadian ones, that gave a talk for the Detroit Trauma Symposium, and they talked like that they were trying to change the paradigm, even in people with traumatic brain injury and obstructive shock, to put the chest tube before the tubes, before the ET tube is inserted. So I know it's not new, and I know people that treat trauma, like very high energy trauma, we understand it. I think we need to, like, it's going to be near impossible for us to produce a randomized controlled trial on this. But what it is possible is that I'm not advocating for creating another paradigm, not for that either, but for us to use our brains and look at guidelines as guidelines and have an opportunity to tailor that guidelines and not be so dogmatic when we treat people that need all the resources that we have in our armamentarium to help them survive, because the only thing that is irreversible in medicine is death. is that the point that I think some of us are making is the saying, oh, we have done this. This is the way that we have done it because this is the way that we have done it. We have always done it that way. It's a super dangerous phrase in science. And it just leads us to stagnation instead of progress.
And I will say that, you know, clinical judgment is obviously very important. And so the blunt trauma patient in a rural location is far different from the urban patient who has penetrating trauma. So to me, for urban penetrating trauma, it's a no-brainer. Don't intubate. Don't do anything. Just get in the ambulance, get in the police car, come to the hospital. Now, someone who's in a rural area and has had a motor vehicle accident or has isolated head trauma that's hypotensive, that person may need an airway, a definitive airway, before reaching definitive care. So, we exist to make clinical decisions, and you have to use clinical judgment and decide what's right for the patient. There's no one algorithm that's going to figure it out for every situation.
Right. And I think that luckily, I mentioned ATLS because it's a trauma Bible. Luckily, in March, we heard from the COT that the new version is going to have, instead of ABC, it's going to be XABC to talk about treating exsanguination. That's wonderful. That's progress. The X is going to refer to exsanguination, but external bleeding because of the Stop the Bleed program and put in tourniquets. I think now the challenge is, what are we going to do when we have non-compressible bleeding with especially these injuries, high caliber, high velocity injuries? This is what we're going to continue to see.
I think that segues nicely into, like, you know, how are we going to bring this out? So if you look at the literature, and certainly you mentioned a bunch of papers that were done recently, I'd say in the last 4 or 5 years or so. But, you know, when you look at this topic, there's a really great paper out of the British Military Journal that was published way back in 2004 that came out of the recent conflicts that kind of really had in the title that, you know, you should be, instead of ABC, it should be CAB. And so, you know, 2004, now it's 2023, still people are not kind of doing this. Still people, as you say, you know, there's a large portion in the United States that are working in community hospitals that are far from a trauma center. And importantly, you know, when you talk to leadership in ATLS, they say, well, we have to cater for the rest of the world as well, who are using this paradigm. So how do you translate that quicker into the general education and make sure that that kind of understanding of physiology is really understood?
Exactly like Dr. Kwasim, doing exactly what you're doing right now is positive peer pressure. Nothing is going to change unless we really all care a whole lot to change it and come together, right? That the phrase in Spanish, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido. Like, we need to all unite together and start questioning paradigms. That not only the ATLS airway within circulation paradigm, paradigms in general. That not take everything like a law, but think about how we can do things to improve the status quo.
But also show the data and do the research and show everybody what the physiology is behind it and, you know, what the outcomes are. Like Dr. Ferrata said, a randomized control trial is probably too difficult to do. But, you know, the more research and the higher quality research we have, the easier it is to change practice.
On that note, how do we convince, you know, we talked a lot about like the trauma, people in the trauma center, but how do we convince providers such as like EMS to just pick up the patient and bring them? Here in Philadelphia, 80 some percent of our patients come via police. So we don't deal with that too much. But in most places, the patients come via EMS and EMS wants to use their skills.
But, and EMS also are willing that if I find a group of people that are willing to question paradigms, are the EMS professionals. I can tell you that at least here in Virginia, they're listening and they're getting trained in ultrasound and they want to learn more and they understand euvolemic resuscitation and they want to, if there's a group of people that we're going to have less of an issue making the change, is going to be the EMS.
Agree with that. It's, you know, I think EMS are kind of really hungry for this knowledge, and we have to give them a little bit more credit than what they sometimes unfortunately get, because they really, I think a lot of this stuff can be altered, like right from the get-go, from the scene. And, you know, what happens there can certainly affect management down the line. Just kind of thinking about, you know, if you look at, we talk about evidence, we talk about this. And interestingly, you know, when you look at the critical care literature, you look at some of the emergency medicine literature, you know, we've been talking about optimizing patients who are physiologically challenged for before intubating. So patient in septic shock, you'll give them fluids, you'll give them pressors before you intubate them. Someone in profound metabolic acidosis, you'll address the acidosis before you intubate them. And it seems like, you know, when you talk to people from other specialties, intensive care, emergency medicine, other specialties, they kind of have that in their head. So why do people just think of trauma as a completely separate disease? Or is the, because those principles really are just what we're talking about here and have been looked at in other areas as well. What do you think?
I think the trauma is a separate disease. If you think about ABCs, it was designed to treat mostly medical conditions. And that's the vast majority of what EMS sees. It's not, you know, it may be different in a city like mine, where unfortunately we're possibly the murder capital of the world now. They see a lot more trauma, but the vast majority of what EMS sees is medical problems that probably should be treated with airway first. So I think we do have to push the fact that trauma is set a very unique physiology and patient population. And, you know, education is the key, and we can't treat all the patients the same.
Education and creating awareness. I think when we get a critical mass of people understanding it and believing it, there will be a shift.
I've got a question for y'all around, you know, keeping in mind that, of course, guidelines are guidelines and clinical decision making is an absolute necessary ingredient in the trauma bay. What clinical scenarios would push you guys to intubate in the ED with the unstable patient?
Well, when you have, I think traumatic brain injury, right, is one of them, one of the things that you have to prioritize. And it's my observation, mostly through what I did when I was doing limited echocardiograms in the trauma bay, that majority of people that are hypotensive are going to be hypovolemic, but there's a subgroup of people that are not hypovolemic, and those are vast majority traumatic brain injury with bad injuries, and then if you actually look physiologically at the heart, those hearts are going to be lazy. They're not hyperdynamic, they're not empty like when you're dying of hypovolemia. They're like barely contracting. Those people, they need to be intubated because of oxygenation. Their perfusion needs to be kept, not with blood or procedures, but with the pressors perhaps, or fluids to make sure that they don't decompensate. But those people, I think I would prioritize intubation when these isolated traumatic brain injury or traumatic, like if you have a traumatic brain injury, you're bleeding, you need to take care of the bleeding too, because the brain gets perfused when you stop bleeding. That would be one for me. Or obvious injuries, like if your patient is choking, or if you have somebody with a face trauma and bleeding is secondary, yes, for sure. We are advocating, and Dr. Tagabi, please don't let me put words in your mouth, but we're advocating for considering circulation first on people that are actively exsanguinating, not on people that have airway obstruction, not on people that have isolated neck injury, not on people with isolated traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I think Dr. Farada hit on the two main patient populations, TBI, and then when the airway is a surgical problem because you have some sort of bad maxillofacial trauma and you have an obstructed airway. So I would agree with that 100%.
So say they are exsanguinating and they've been shot in the face and they're vomiting.
Well, that is a challenging problem. I think you can do everything at the same time. You can have an airway and give blood and prepare to have ultimate control of bleeding.
Just looking at kind of that ABC paradigm, what do you think? You know, people were saying, I remember bringing this up at the recent ATLS conference. Well, you know, there's still airway issues and breathing issues like attention pneumo and things that need to be looked for and addressed first. So should we be kind of looking at, supporting the airway, or does airway always mean you have to intubate? And is this kind of the flaw in the education where people automatically equate airway to intubation?
I think it's somewhat of a flaw in the algorithm that people do kind of go to intubate too quickly. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I'm totally fine with simple airway maneuvers, whether that's oral airway or jaw thrust. I think, you know, I'm all for simple maneuvers to open the airway. I just think the physiology around endotracheal intubation is what can get people into trouble.
I agree 100%. I think that airway not necessarily means intubation. Airway means airway. Put a little bit of oxygen, jaw thrust, oral airway, everything that Dr. Chakavi said as well.
Do you think for some of these complex patients, like we were talking about, where they have multi-cavitary injury plus and maybe have, you know, facial trauma and need intubation, is this where understanding the system you're in and what resources could be available to you to like push your institution so that you can manage those things all at once? Like, for example, like having a blood bridge in your trauma bay and, you know, having the rapid transfuser and those types of resources available. So when you are dealing with these complex patients, you have everything you need, so you can manage everything all at once.
Absolutely. And I think that not part of this talk about physiology and managing trauma patients, but it's still part of it and part about everything that we do in clinical medicine. This is the reason why surgeons and physicians, we need to be sitting at the tables where the decisions are being taken. If you're not sitting at the table, you're part of the menu. And if there's people that are removed from clinical care, making decisions about your trauma bay, then decisions that are not going to benefit patient care are going to be taken. So we need to own it. We need to be part of the conversation. We need to be in those spaces having been part of these critical decisions. Otherwise, decisions are going to be taken without us, which is never good for the patient.
On kind of that same kind of theme and working within this system, how important do you all see things like trauma simulation and video review and those types of educational activities in making people understand why we're doing things the way we do them so that they kind of get on board with some of these changing paradigms?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. As you know, Dr. Darrow, I'm sure it still goes on at Temple, we did a lot of trauma video review. You know, that's why sports teams watch video after every game. It's the best way to learn about your mistakes and try to think about how you would do better next time. So to me, it's a huge tool. And now there's actually more data coming out on it that it's extremely educational to do that type of stuff. And I would say the same with simulation. I think that's a great tool, particularly in these scenarios where the paradigm is kind of changing. As we talk about doing circulation first, and we talk about how are we going to change practice, I think that simulation and both video review are great tools to do those things.
It, you know, the education aspect of it really kind of reminds us of, you know, what is the physiology of hemorrhagic shock. And, you know, the Dr. Ferrata mentioned earlier that the patient appears short of breath or with increased work of breathing. And really, that's the manifestation of air hunger from profound metabolic acidosis that these patients are serving. And Dr. Dower probably attest to this in Philadelphia, you know, with the rapid transport from the police, we see this physiology, this kind of almost end stage physiology that perhaps other centers with longer transport times don't see because they arrive to us so quickly. And so attest to that, you know, people who come in and are shocked and are air hunger, and then, you know, if you try to intubate them, you'll never match their minute ventilation unless you've corrected that shock state. And so I think if you push this forward as, you know, you're addressing the shock and what's causing the shock, and then it kind of puts more focus on what the physiology is and how this affects things. So that's well and good about the single patient that ends up coming in. You know, and again, as Dr. Dower will attest, sometimes the police will bring us one patient, sometimes the police will bring us three patients all at the same time with no warning. So does location matter? Say you've trained your team, you've done the video review, you've talked to, you know, your team, and everybody's like working and buying into this CAB approach, but there's one surgeon, two people have to go to the OR. Would it be okay to say, hey, okay, one goes to the OR, gets intubated up there, but the other person who's also exsanguinating gets some form of hemorrhage control and gets blood products and maybe a Reboa if that's appropriate, and then can still be intubated in the ED? Or is that still not? Does location matter or does the principle matter?
It's the principle. It's not the location. It's not the tool, right? So I see this a lot when people are arguing about Reboa and trying to vilify that and compare with thoracotomy. It's not what saves the patient's life. It's not the Reboa balloon and it's not the clamp that you place in the aorta. It's the surgeon working with the patient and making it better. It's the team with anesthesia, with emergency medicine physicians and everybody and nurses and everybody together and EMS professionals, everybody working together and doing what's best for the patient. So I think that we need to just, it's going to be useful for the patient if we can move away from the mindset of like either blaming or singling out, is the ER, is the scene, is the Reboa, is the clamp, is the knife? No. What we need to focus is in the physiological patterns and how can we use the tools that we have to help the patient in need.
Yeah, I think it's more of a function of time to definitive control of hemorrhage rather than location.
Right. It's not a golden hour anymore. Their injuries are bleeding a liter per minute. It's platinum 10 minutes.
I think this has been really a fascinating kind of discussion about this whole principle, and something that really I hope from this trauma cast people will start thinking about a lot more, especially outside of the level one centers. But there's still a lot of work to do. So how can we either collaborate, or what should we be doing as a trauma community? Not just thinking about our own patients, but also kind of thinking about the low and middle income countries that are seeing a horrible amount of trauma from really significant injuries and potentially, you know, causing some iatrogenic insult from their current practice. So where do we need to take this?
So everywhere and anywhere. So talk about it, tweet about it, have podcasts about it, publish about it. Normalize talking about it. Understand that the trauma team is not only the surgeon, but we have anesthesia, emergency medicine professionals, nursing. Just make it impossible to miss.
Yeah, I would agree. Collaborate, talk about it. You know, Zaf came to New Orleans and spoke at a EMS conference that we were throwing. So talk about it, collaborate, publish, write papers in JAMA Surgery, as Dr. Ferrata recently did, and kind of get the awareness out there. And keep pushing the envelope and improving care.
Yeah, this is definitely a great multidisciplinary topic that we can all come together and essentially and ultimately make things better for our patients. So thank you guys so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys giving up your time and discussing this really important topic. We will most certainly project your voice to the rest of the community through this podcast and other channels as you advise.
Yeah, thanks again for being here. You know, I think this is an incredibly important topic, and I think we all are practicing as circulation first every day, you know, in our clinical settings. And it's just about getting everybody on board and understanding the importance of this changing paradigm.
No, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I consider it an honor to be able to have this conversation and to share this time with all of you and with Dr. Zaghavi. And thank you for including me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you all, and hope I can do it again sometime soon.
For more information on today's TraumaCast, please refer to the link in the supplemental material section.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer. And make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.